I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Jackson County government has seen a lot of turbulence lately. Right now, the three big issues to deal with are a property tax reassessment mess, the need for a new jail, and the alleged misuse of millions of dollars intended to combat drug use and violence. Needless to say, there's a lot to cover. Here to discuss it today are two county legislators, Chairwoman Teresa Galvin and freshman Jalen Anderson. Then, American history is plagued with racism, and you don't have to go that far back to find examples. We'll learn about the segregation of Mexican Americans in Kansas City, Kansas schools as late as the 1950s. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The Jackson County Legislature doesn't typically get much attention, but these aren't typical times. The legislature is rejecting a proposed tax increase by Frank White. It's trying to straighten out a horror show of a mess with its property valuation process. In the eyes of many, it still needs to build a new jail, and lawmakers are still digesting the findings of a new audit that concluded that millions of dollars that were intended for the Combat Anti-Drug Program were spent on other county needs. In short, there's a lot going on. Not much of it is good. With us here to talk about this are two county legislators. They are Teresa Galvin. She's the legislative chairwoman. Teresa, nice to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Jalen Anderson is the first district at-large legislator. Jalen, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, Teresa, you know, critics say Jackson County doesn't have that many responsibilities, and even then, it's managing to screw up most of those duties. What do you say to that?
The responsibilities that we have are very detrimental to the people of Jackson County. We are assessing your properties. We are, you know, telling you how much you're going to have to pay in taxes. And that is a very, very important responsibility of Jackson County.
And you have the jail, and that crisis isn't playing out, at least very evenly, at least a lot of people say.
Absolutely. Well, with the last resolution that we did vote down, we just felt that it was $8.8 million of taxpayers' dollars that they wanted us to spend. And there isn't much trust right now with the audit from the combat and with what's going on with the reassessment. So I personally couldn't tell my constituents, I'm going to spend almost $9 million of your money now.
We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. Okay. Jalen, you're relatively new to the legislature. You took office in January, elected in 2018, and you're the youngest member on the body. What's your perspective? Is the legislature an effective body? Is the county government working?
Right now, the short answer is county government working? No. But the fact is that there are people on the legislature like Teresa who have been trying to bring us back into alignment to work for the people of Jackson County. We can be effective. We can do things that will change our community for the better. The problem is that I believe that we have allowed personalities, and we have allowed egos, and we have allowed personal opinions to take control of what should be done for the taxpayers.
You know, I was going to say, just to be blunt here, the legislature, at least in recent years, has been comprised of a whole lot of veteran members who have been around county government for not just a few years, but decades. That would suggest they know the way government ought to work. They should know where money's being hidden in, you know, different places. And these big problems should be dealt with by veteran people.
You know, I respect my colleagues and my predecessors who have come before, but I will say that I am happy to bring a new perspective to county government, as Teresa did 4 years ago. Her also not being this individual who's been there for years and years and years, but also, and I'd like to say, being the first woman Republican to be the chair of the legislature. I think we're changing, we're moving away from the old ways, and that's the most important thing. The old ways is what created the distrust of people of this government. And even though we're going through these disagreements, I believe they're growing pains. I think we're bringing to light a lot of the wrongs that have been done, and that I think Jackson County can really be the true leader that it should be in this region.
Teresa, do you think the culture is changing? Are you having success on that front?
Absolutely, the culture is changing. We have had more transparency. In the past, our meetings, some of them would last a whole 5 minutes. Now you're lucky if you get out of there after 90 minutes. Hmm. So we are having a lot more conversations. And as he said, you know, it's not Republican or Democrat. It's not man or woman. It's all of us coming together and having an open conversation, whether it makes some people uncomfortable or not.
It sounds like you think the culture has needed to change.
It has. And I have a lot of respect for the previous legislators. However, people in general become comfortable once they've been in a position too long.
Okay, let's talk about the combat audit, and that was completed by State Auditor Nicole Galloway. Teresa, how is it possible that two consecutive county executives, and I'm referring to Mike Sanders and now to Frank White, were able to spend millions of dollars of sales taxes intended for combat on a host of expenses not related to stopping violence or stopping the impact of the use of illegal drugs in Jackson County, which is what the purpose of combat is supposed to be? How could that have happened?
Well, the audit that we have right now was from BKD, an accounting firm.
Okay,
we haven't
right.
received the results back from Nicole yeah. Galloway's. They would. So we have to, anything over $10,000 comes in front of the legislature for approval. So they would just put it through at $9,999. That's how they paid for the truck for the chief of staff.
Who would put it through that way?
The county executive's mm-hmm. office. And so they would have, you know, their people in the different departments that basically had to follow the rules or they would get fired.
So they put through an expenditure for a truck at $9,999, but the truck in theory cost more than that.
They did multiple transfers.
Multiple transfers.
Multiple transfers of the cost below $10,000.
Why was that permitted to happen time and time again?
Because, as I said, you have people in those departments that want to keep their jobs. So you have a person that goes down and says, do this transfer. You do the transfer or you lose your job. And that was done in payroll, which is why we're in the situation where we have one person who did lose his job. He was a senior in the financial department and he was asked to leave.
Does that situation continue to be in play now going forward?
I think it does in some instances. I still think there's some funny business going on that they're not telling us about. For example, there are people getting raises that we're supposed to be on a freeze right now. We're in the middle of a work study so that we can give people increases across the county, you know, as a whole. Instead, there are select people that are receiving increases at the tune of 32%. Hmm. And their productivity does not justify that.
I want to be clear about one point, Teresa. You're saying these expenditures that go through for $9,999, these do not come before the legislature. They're just ordered through the administration?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Jalen, what do you make of this? It's not often you hear this kind of candor from elected officials. What do you make of this?
I will say since coming on the legislature, I think we've had more candor than we have in the past. But everything that Teresa said is completely correct, and I agree with her as well about that this has to change. The entire discussion that any monies, any taxpayer monies, goes past the legislature and is automatically implemented, I think it has to change, and it's not right.
This notion that bureaucrats were told to put through an expenditure mm-hmm. for $9,999 or you're going to lose your job. Are there actors still within the bureaucracy who are demanding that of their lower level colleagues? They're threatening them with their jobs unless they put these expenditures through at that level?
You know, I can't say that they are continuing those conversations, but the same people who did this and demanded this from workers at Jackson County are still there. And that's a problem. That's a very big problem.
That's breathtaking that kind of thing was part of, it sounds like, routine business at Jackson County Courthouse.
Yes. And it's the whole reason of government is that it provides a service that should be unwaveringly honest and helpful to the taxpayers and to the people. This whole idea
it's their
that
money.
It's their money. But the whole idea that we're having this conversation still and that we still have the people in place who have done this really shows the moral compass here is completely off. We have to start holding more people accountable. One thing that the legislature has, and I think is something that I hope we move towards, and I know Teresa has voiced this before, but that we are the oversight. We are the oversight body for this government. The problem is, though, the charter itself needs to be reworded in a way that gives us the ability to actually be the check to not only the administration, but to the prosecutor's office and to the sheriff's department.
But it just was reworded.
Yes, but
voters just approved a series of changes at the last election.
That's correct. But the problem is that what those changes were just a Band-Aid. It was not dealing with the actual problem that's going on there. There should be more discussions and more abilities that the legislature can bring, not only things that are below $10,000, that they have to come to us, that they have to be voted on, that they have to be discussed in every which way, but that people who work in Jackson County can come to us and say, this is a problem that I'm facing, mm-hmm. and not feel like that they have to be silenced. And that's something that, you know, when you're just walking down the hallways there, you can tell that there is a problem with people being they're at their jobs and they don't feel like they're proud to be working at Jackson
County.
There's
a tension.
There's a tension. There's not that ability to relate to people, that you got to watch your back. That's not how any of this should be.
You know, Teresa Galvin, as the chairwoman of the Jackson County Legislature, when you learn of these kinds of transactions taking place, bids being sort of worked, expenditures being worked so they come in under the $10,000 threshold, do you ever go to Jackson County Executive Frank White and say, Frank, there's this $9,999 expenditure for a new vehicle for your office. Why don't you just bring it in for the full price? What are we doing here? This isn't being fully transparent with taxpayers.
To be honest, I've gone to him with several situations.
And what do you hear?
I need to look into that and I'll get back with you.
Does he ever get back to you?
One thing he did get back with me about, and it's because I had to go to him three times and say, you never got back with me. And that was on the person that received the 32% increase.
Mm-hmm.
And he had his chief administrative officer get back with me. And that person said, well, we gave him the increase because his supervisor was afraid he was going to leave. Mm-hmm. So no, I don't get an answer. Yes, I ask the questions. And quite honestly, I have given up asking the questions because I know I'm never going to get the answer. I don't think he knows, quite honestly.
Frank White doesn't know the answers.
Absolutely. I think he's got the people working around him, and he trusts those people. As you know, Jalen and I have people that work with us, and we trust the people that work with us also. So I believe he trusts his people the same way we trust ours.
So again, just to be clear, you're aware of one employee who got a 32% pay increase, even though there's a pay freeze going on at Jackson County right now.
Absolutely. We've got people that work at the county that use our services. They go to food banks. They're on food stamps. They're making $10 an hour, and they can't make ends meet. If they have a flat tire, it's devastating for them.
Yeah.
So that's a huge issue for me.
Going back to the combat audit, Jalen, to what extent did these results surprise you? The findings that county executives were able to spend millions of bucks on other services besides what they were intended for and what taxpayers had voted on at election time.
I will say that I hate to say this, but I was not shocked because of the environment that is the Jackson County government. And even before I came on working on campaigns and those different types of things, you'd always hear about these stories. And it's a shame that the Sanders administration and the White administration has continued this. And I'm sure this has gone on even when this was created, combat itself. But the problem is that we are facing such a crisis in our area with violence, with the amount of drug overdoses that keep happening. We are not. This is not the time at all to even consider spending any amount of taxpayer money outside of treatment, but also preventing violence and keeping families safe. That's what it should be.
To be specific, this audit found that instead of spending money on fighting illegal drugs, it was spent on things like chain link fences, vans, elevator repair, the salary of Frank White's chief of staff, his director of communications. No one noticed that at the legislature to bring it to your attention?
I know.
Before the audit?
You know, I know that my predecessors had the idea, and I know that they were doing their best to combat that, in using the same word, but to try to mm-hmm. deal with that. But when you're when there is no discussion, when things are purposefully put under the table, it's very difficult as a legislator coming onto this. It's very difficult to see what the administrations are doing.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot see these things coming. And the last minute, as soon as you're about ready to pass something that might have real substance, they want to bring this up. And then all of a sudden you have to look at it. But it's going to kill the entire ordinance or resolution. And I'm not saying that you should pass something that's corrupt in any which way, shape, or form. But
you want more transparency.
You cannot continue, and the administrations and whoever comes after Frank and how we keep going on like this, there has to be discussion between the executive and the legislature, because this is exactly why people don't trust their government. The amount of money that has been spent outside of combat, or that was the combat money that they used outside of that, is ridiculous. Because what – if we intend to change our society, government has to be able to lead. We're not be able to lead like this. You can't bring up things at the last minute. You can't expect us just to sit by and say, well, that's all right, we'll get them next time, or maybe we'll have a discussion about it. The time for talking is done. There needs to be change now.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about ongoing struggles and challenges involving the Jackson County Legislature, Jackson County government. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. I'm joined here in the studio this morning by two members of the legislature, Teresa Galvin, who's the chairwoman, and Jalen Anderson, who's the first district at large legislator. You know, Teresa, one of the big issues for any number of months now has been a fracture, if you will, in the relationship between the Jackson County Legislature and County Executive Frank White. Where is that relationship today? You know, how much of a problem is it that these relations aren't any better?
I think it got a lot worse Monday when we didn't vote for his amendment to the levy.
He wanted a $3 million tax cut. The legislature rejected it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It was, to me, it was an insult. If we would have voted for it, it would have said that, you know, it would have said that we approved of his reassessment process this year.
Mm-hmm.
And we do not approve of it. Basically, it was, hey, I'm going to increase your taxes this large amount, but then I'm going to give you $20. And that was insulting. It was a slap in the face, and I didn't agree with it.
Had he talked to you about that proposal ahead of time?
No. Actually, I received a text message the Sunday night before saying, hey, what do you think about this? And that's when I read it. And then the following Monday, he was not at the meeting to even say, you know, this is what I'm proposing or this is what I want to discuss. He was in Nashville at a Kansas City Chamber event.
And this is a fairly significant policy proposal he was presenting. And you're saying there wasn't much spade work done ahead of time.
There was no conversation with the legislature. And,
yeah,
you know, at that point, he should have picked up the phone and called and said, this is what I'm thinking about doing. You know, what are your thoughts? And there's no communication. We should be working together and we're not.
There's no communication, and obviously at any governmental body, that's a big issue.
Absolutely. And he'll say, and he has said many times, you know, just pick up the phone and call me. Well, I can tell you on three different times that we've had conversations, he said, I need to run in here and I'll call you back, and he never calls back.
Hmm. Jalen, has that been your experience too?
You know, and at the beginning when I was first elected and working, there was an ability to call and have those conversations. At the beginning, when we had January, February, March, it started to fizzle out. And, you know, to Teresa's point, that's fine. We can pick up the phone and call you. But when you propose a policy, you can call us. It's a two-way street here.
It's a two-way street.
This is not, if this is your policy that you're wanting to enact that we have not done before, something that especially this has this much tension in the community, explain to us what you're wanting to do.
Mm-hmm.
Not one of your staff, not that we hear about it on Sunday night or on Monday. You call us. Call us and say what you're thinking. Because I think there would be an understanding of more respect of that you're trying to get our opinion while we're trying to pass legislation.
He was proposing this tax cut, if you want to call it that, on Sunday, and he wanted it voted on Monday, or is it a week later?
1 week later.
1 week later. Right. Okay.
If he sent out the press release on the 22nd.
Yeah.
The night of the 22nd. Mm-hmm.
Jalen, you would characterize the relationship between the legislature and lawmakers as what right now? At the legislature and Frank White as what?
I will say it's problematic. And the reason why I say it's problematic is because the only people that are affected by this strife, by this disagreement, are the taxpayers and the residents of Jackson County. And that is no way that a government should act in any way.
Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888 as we talk about struggles and challenges inside Jackson County government. Rosalind from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
All right. Your people, who legislators who are there with you right now, have talked about people being afraid to lose their job if they report something that doesn't look right to them. But even though I know we're having trouble with the whistleblower thing on the national level right now, is there any kind of whistleblower protection for county employees who do that?
Good question. What about that, Teresa Galvin?
There is a whistleblower phone number that people can call, and some have, which is how we have found out about some of the information.
Yeah. Okay. Let's turn to the reassessment process, which has had so many homeowners up in arms. Teresa, if you would, give us an update on where we stand today. I know property owners are still upset. A lot of them are seeing tax bills. They're expecting to see tax bills far higher than a year ago. I know extensions have been granted for a lot of folks here, but where do we stand today?
Right now, they're at the appeal process with the Board of Equalization, the BOE. And what we have done is we have hired some hearing officers. So we actually have a station set up so the taxpayer can go in, speak with the hearing officer. They'll have all their information and try to come up with an agreement. If they come up with an agreement, then that stipulation is what it's called, is taken in front of the BOE, and the BOE either approves or disapproves. Mm-hmm. If the hearing officer does not come up with an agreement with the taxpayer, then they go through the normal appeal process in front of the Board of Equalization.
I'm wondering, how many appeals do you have stacked up? Because I know so many folks actually wound up filing appeals.
Right. I don't even know what the balance is right now. I know that they're trying to see between 300 and 400 a day, and 4 days a week.
4 days a week.
Right.
So still several thousand, is that fair to say?
Absolutely. We're going to go in probably the end of January to February, to be realistic.
And what's the impact on that? Because you all need to set levies, governmental agencies and bodies around the county need to set their budgets. That's awfully difficult to do if they don't know what the property valuation total is inside of Jackson County.
Actually, October 1st was the deadline to set the levy, so everyone has set their levies.
They just had to go take a guess?
They had to do it. I believe the Kansas City School District did not lower theirs. A lot of the other school districts did lower their levies. So that's...
Jalen, I'm wondering, you know, this has been a painful process for so many homeowners, business owners. In the long run, is this going to pay off, this, you know, short-term pain for what hopefully will be a longer-term, you know, values that make more sense to a lot of people, are closer to market value?
No, I don't believe so at all. And the reason why I say that is if paying off right now, the best thing we can look at is you know, there's a little bit more of tax money coming in to the different taxing jurisdictions, because Jackson County has 7%, if I'm right on that, 7% of the taxes that come in. But the problem is that the amount of emails and phone calls that Teresa has gotten, and so have I and our colleagues, people are going to lose their homes over this. This is not something just to pull at our heartstrings. This is not something just to get in the newspaper or on the news.
Their taxes are going up that much, they're actually going to lose their homes.
That much. And the problem is, you know, my mother, who was a nurse for nearly 30 years, who's on Social Security disability, I take care of her now. But if she was still in her home, out in Blue Springs, Eastern Jackson County area, she couldn't afford her tax bill at the end of the year. We've seen increases like that. I'm in a position that I'm able to take care of her, and we're going to be all right. But the folks who are on Social Security disability, retired, working minimum wage jobs, just trying to get by, they shouldn't have to have this struggle, this stress. Government should not be in the business of doing this at all. And, you know, with this assessment going on and the discussions going back and forth, if I may, Steve, I know the executive had said that, Frank White had said that This had nothing to do with assessment. This $3 million tax cut came up after the reporting from Angie Rocono that whole week before. Mm-hmm. This is when this came out. Also, you don't propose legislation at night if you're really serious about this. Mm-hmm. And so the reason why, and this ties in completely to this, why this was a slap in the face, as Teresa said, to the taxpayer, this is giving false hope. $20 is not going to save people's homes. Mm-hmm. $20 is not going to alleviate the stress of how am I going to make it. And also, the idea of selling one's home just to not feel the tax burden or to even get a loan is ridiculous. And it's completely out of touch with reality.
Let me just turn to one final point here that, Teresa, you made at the beginning of our conversation here today. At this point, just to be clear, the reconstruction, the building of a new Jackson County jail, that's off the table for now until a lot of these matters get resolved?
For me, it is. For me, I can't justify spending the money.
Is the majority of the legislature feels the same way?
It is. I do believe that most of us feel the same way. I know that Kansas City is looking for property. I think they're in the process of starting to build a jail. I would still, down the line, like to work with Kansas City and build something together. I just think that makes sense for everyone involved.
Is any prospects for that happening?
Let's get over the reassessment and then look at that process.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you both coming in today to share your views about what's going on there. We weren't sure about a lot of things that were happening down there, so I really appreciate your comments. Teresa Galvin is the legislative chairwoman with the Jackson County Legislature. Jalen Anderson is the first district at-large lawmaker. Thank you all very much. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve, for having us.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about immigrants coming into Kansas City, Kansas, and the challenges they faced. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you go to kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe to Kraske Off Mic, then every Monday I'll send right to your inbox my insights on guests and topics from the program and up-to-date highlights. Don't miss out. Sign up at kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, meet the Kansas author who pulled back the curtain on the pesticide ingredient that has launched over 13,000 lawsuits in this country and has been declared a probable cancer risk by the World Health Organization. That's on Up to Date tomorrow. Well, immigrants crossing our southern border to find a better life in America is not new. The late 1800s and early 1900s saw a migration of Mexican workers to the Kansas City area who toiled in its rail yards and its meatpacking plants. The history of that time and of those immigrants is not widely known, but it's not unfamiliar. Like other minorities at that time, Mexicans experienced discrimination and segregation in where they could live, socialize, worship, and today's topic, where they could go to school. Here to tell us about this chapter in Kansas City and Mexican-American history is Daniel Cerda. He works on urban revitalization at the Local Initiative Support Corporation. Daniel, welcome back. So good to have you here.
Good morning. Good to see you.
Well, I'm just wondering how difficult it was for these Mexicans to assimilate here in Kansas City in this area. What's your research telling you?
It was incredibly challenging. You had a period in the early days when Mexicans were being recruited from the deep interior of Mexico by railroads to principally the Santa Fe and the Kansas City Southern, which at the time in the late 19th century were building to the Pacific coast in Mexico. Mm-hmm. We often forget that that route to the Southwest was as much about reaching Mexico's Pacific coast as it was California's. And Mexicans started working on those railroads in the 1860s and 1870s, if you can believe that. In the late 19th century, when the United States government restricted immigration specifically of Chinese laborers and then later of Slavic and Eastern European laborers, both the railroads in Kansas City and the meatpacking plants in Kansas City and Milwaukee and St. Louis and Chicago and other interior cities had to look for another source of labor. Mm-hmm. And there was skilled labor tied into the railroads in Mexico that was basically recruited on a seasonal basis. So think about this in the first sense that you have men, able-bodied men, you know, in their teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, being recruited to work in the labor yards to do everything from lay track to actually assemble the rail cars in the freight yards initially, and doing that on a seasonal basis, coming up in the spring, being sent back home in the fall, on the presumption that they are basically visitors here, right? They're not intended to establish any ties and that sort of thing. People are often astounded to learn that that happened in Kansas City as early as the 1890s.
Huh.
By 1910, there were over 50% of the workers in the rail yards in Kansas City, Kansas, were Mexican Americans.
When these Mexicans arrive in Kansas City, Daniel, for those railroad jobs, which parts of the city did they go to live?
They were predominantly in the Armourdale and Argentine areas of Kansas City, Kansas. You know, we're very familiar with the Hispanic West Side. The West Side actually was only about a third of the local Mexican population of immigrants. The other two-thirds were on the Kansas side because that's where most of the railroad infrastructure, the major yards, were located. There were smaller yards on the Missouri side.
I'm just wondering, they were segregated by their jobs, you know, which had them living literally on what some call the wrong side of the tracks. They had to deal with communication barriers, which had to further separate them. We have a sense of just how tough it was, you know, for them to deal with all that?
Well, the working conditions were terrible. You know, it was long hours. There weren't labor restrictions in there that created an eight-hour day back in that period. Railroad work in itself is incredibly dangerous.
I was going to say.
Being in and around those freight cars, you know, people can be killed by, you know, simply, you know, stepping in the wrong place. There's, you know, all of the toxins in the air from the diesel emissions, but initially the coal emissions, right? They're in and around. I mean, these workers are in, you know, the depths of some of the most dangerous and hazardous work for very low pay. And again, in a very tenuous circumstance where they're not expected to establish any kind of familial ties, any kind of community ties. They're certainly not expected to acquire property. But over time, that's what started happening. That kind of pattern of literally recruiting and then re-exporting that labor started to break down over time.
Despite it all,
they began to assimilate. They began to marry. They began to bring up members of their family. People were recruited by members of their family who had been able to save up enough, you know, one winter doing other work in Mexico and come and actually buy a small house in the Argentine area, that sort of thing. And over time, by the teens and 20s, you had a community of over 10,000 Mexican-Americans living in Kansas City, Kansas. Mm.
Then the Spanish flu hit in 1918 during the war. What concerns did that raise among the non-Hispanic population?
Well, there was what you might call near hysteria. I mean, it was a major pandemic. People were literally dying all over the city. I've found through other research that I've been really interesting anecdotes about, you know, you see a history of a neighborhood where all of a sudden there, you know, there are five or six people that have passed away in a space. And you look at the obituaries, and it's very clear, you know, what had happened was the people just succumbed to the flu. The unfortunate thing, and again, it may not seem as trite as, you know, the fact that it was called Spanish flu, but there was a very strong association.
How was it called Spanish flu?
Well, because it was actually an extract that was traced to Spain. And ironically, it was actually brought to the United States by returning veterans from World War I who were coming back from Spain to Fort Riley in Kansas. So Kansas was actually one of the flashpoints for the pandemic.
I can't imagine how much more difficult that made it for the Mexican workers, the Spanish people who are here to begin with anyway.
Well, one of the very typical patterns you see in major cities going back to the early 19th century on the East Coast was the association of these very congested, really unhealthy living environments that immigrants lived in with disease. And so there was a natural proclivity on the part of the general population to look at, you know, these ethnic communities that were living in disadvantaged circumstances and say, you know, those are not healthy conditions. I don't want people coming out of that neighborhood. For example, I don't want kids coming out of that neighborhood going to school with my kids because my kids may succumb to illness because of that. Everything from, you know, lice to flu to, you know, the basic cold, any contagion. And again, that's also at a period before vaccination, right? And there's a lot of suspicion and a lot of superstition almost about the transmission of disease. But there's a very strong imprint of association of immigrant neighborhoods with disease as early as the early 19th century in the United States. And that certainly played out here in the early 20th century. And it was one of the first, you know, impetuses for the creation of segregated schools.
What about the schools themselves? What choices did Mexican families have for educating their own kids?
Well, you know, what's interesting here is that the way that the narrative is played out in the local media at the time is that, you know, it's very clear there's a backdrop that Mexican children have been attending schools for some period of time. It's not even entirely clear without going back and parsing some of those records. It's not clear if those records even exist when the first Mexican students enrolled in schools in Kansas City, Kansas.
In public schools.
In public schools. But they were certainly attending because what happened by about 1918 or so is you have the PTAs, the parents coming together in two schools specifically, one in Armourdale, the John Jay Ingalls School and then the Emerson School over in Argentine, and basically lobbying the school board and saying, we're not comfortable with Mexican children attending school with our children, specifically because of this concern about disease. There was also there were concerns about acculturation and about assimilation and the idea that, you know, really raising eyebrows and raising questions about, is it even legally required that these students be educated? If they are, they certainly don't need to be educated with our students. Remember in 1896, the Supreme Court in Plessy versus Ferguson said separate but equal.
It's just fine.
It's just fine. Yeah. And that was with regard to public transit, but it was translated into the public schools as you can have separate schools. And the way that that manifested itself in Kansas City, Kansas was really initially through segregated classrooms. Those students were relegated to the basements of those schools initially, and then eventually through the construction of two separate segregated schools.
And I hate to ask, what were the conditions like in those basements?
They were terrible. I mean, the basements themselves were not designed as classrooms. Were the basements.
Of course
they
not.
They were dank, they were dark. These are buildings where, you know, the mechanical system was basically a large boiler to provide heat during the winter. There was no air conditioning, right? There were no mechanical ventilation systems in those schools that were built back in the 1880s and 1890s. And literally you can see through the architectural plans, which we were able to examine of some of those schools, that the students were housed in the rooms adjacent to the boilers. So, you know, there's inadequate lighting, inadequate ventilation, and you have as many as 80 students relegated to a classroom with one teacher, right?
In multiple ages and grades.
80 students in a class. You know, I've had people ask me, was that because of language barriers? Like, you got to realize by 1918, when this is happening, many of the children being adversely affected are U.S. citizens. They are Mexican Americans. They are the children of Mexican immigrants who were born in Kansas City, Kansas. Many of those people are no longer with us. There are a handful that still are. And I've actually was able to interview some of them. And I've actually even had some folks reach out to me. I had a gentleman from Florida a few years ago who came across the article that I wrote several years back about this, write to me and through Facebook and say, you know, that was me. I actually might be in that picture. I went to that school back in 1947.
When you said 80 students to a class, that was quickly thinking, were there enough teachers to take on these students? And was that a reason for class sizes being that enormous?
I don't even know if it's a matter of whether there were enough teachers. I think it was simply the presumption that, you know, we have a group of students who need to be educated. We will assign a teacher to be the teacher for them. You know, eventually John Jay Ingalls, that population was large enough that they actually built a physically separate facility, basically trailers in the schoolyard to house those students. But again, within the parameters of constitutional law as it was understood at the time, that was separate but equal. And again, it wasn't until 1954 in Brown v. Board that the Supreme Court said separate is inherently unequal, as evidenced in part by the evidence of the unequal facilities provided to different children.
Daniel Cerda is here. We're talking about the assimilation of Hispanics, Latinos, Mexicans into the Kansas City area going back any number of years here in our area. And I should point out that Daniel will be speaking about a hidden legacy of segregation, Mexican-American children in KCK schools, 1922 to 1951. It'll be at 6 p.m. next Wednesday. That's a week from tonight at the Kansas City, Kansas Public Library, South Branch. That's on Strong Avenue. That's next a week on Wednesday evening, 3104 Strong Avenue here. So what recourse did the Mexican parents have here? I mean, did they have any allies in getting their sons and daughters a proper education, or were they just on their own fighting a system that they had no control over?
Well, initially they were entirely on their own. And I think, you know, for decades, probably at least two decades, they suffered under those conditions. They simply suffered them. They were probably grateful that their children were able to be educated at all. One of the things that came out in the early 1920s was that the presumption about Mexican students was that they would not need to be educated. This is the school district. The school district assumed they would not need to be educated beyond about the sixth grade, because by that point, and again, think about what that means, 11, 12, 13 years old maybe, they're going to go to work. And they're going to become laborers, and they therefore don't, maybe eighth grade at the top range. And so there's two major controversies that come to the fore where the two Mexican families actually find leverage in the Mexican consul's office in Kansas City. And again, people find it astounding. We had a consular office for the Mexican government in Kansas City, Missouri, as early as the 1920s. Again, testament to the size of the population.
And what could the consul general do to help?
What the consul did was, in the initial case, which was the Melville School, which I'll talk more about next week, in the Rosedale area, the consul actually reached out to the United States Department of State in Washington and to the Mexican embassy in D.C., traveled to Washington, met with the Secretary of State, the Secretary of State in turn met with the governor of the state of Kansas. And the argument that they made, there were basically two legal arguments they made. The first was that under the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, through which Mexico ceded a large part of its territory to the United States, Mexicans, Mexican nationals, Mexican citizens were to be afforded certain rights in the United States. And their argument was the right to education is among those. The second was that under the 14th Amendment, and this is a very early iteration of this argument, probably the earliest that's been documented, they made the argument that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment
applied
to Mexicans. That was not case law. The United States Supreme Court had not considered that question.
What did the governor
point.
Say about that, Daniel?
Well, their response was, again, you know, Plessy versus Ferguson prevailed. So let's find accommodation. Let's find an accommodation that will pacify the local parents who are agitated and concerned about this. That case of the Melville School was described in the local media, which was the Kansas City Kansan, which at the time was actually published by the school district. It was described as a mob outside that school of 200 parents that were there to forcibly remove those five children that had deigned to show up for fifth grade, sometime in the fall of 1924. The accommodation that was reached was that new school building replaced an older schoolhouse that dated to the 1880s. That 1880 schoolhouse shall become the Mexican annex where the Mexican children will be educated.
I was just going to say, how many schools were eventually built for Mexican-American kids in KCK?
There was the Mexican annex. There were there was the annex building built next to John J. Ingalls. And then there was the Clara Barton School that was built in Argentine that year, 1923, 1924.
Are those buildings still there?
Specifically, none. None of them exist anymore. The Clara Barton School was actually destroyed by the 1951 flood, but it was still in active use as a segregated Mexican school until 1951.
Are there any records that are still around that would sort of show us how many students were actually educated?
There are. They're in the possession of the school district, and there's a lot of sensitivity about student privacy concerns about that, as I found out when I asked to access some of those records.
Even today, 100 years later?
Even today.
100 years later?
Let me just be frank about it. There was so much sensitivity about it. At the time I was a faculty member at the University of Kansas, we actually had to get the University General Counsel's office involved in that discussion about whether or not the school district was required to provide access. The straight answer is yes, those technically are now public because federal law only restricts student records for 70 years, and that was nearly a century ago.
So they should be public.
They should be public.
But they have not been made public.
They have not been made public. I was able to actually look at microfilm ledgers of student enrollment, and again, it confirmed there were dozens of students in active attendance at that school for at least two decades.
The people you've heard from about their experiences in KCK at these segregated schools, what do they tell you about it?
Well, the primary thing is that, it's a very shameful legacy to them. They knew that they were there despite the best efforts of others to deprive them of an education. One of the things that I had, members of the community tell me is, we struggled against that. And that made us even more assertive with our own children and with our grandchildren than the need for them to be educated and to have the right to be educated.
There was a sense that was step one to sort of
absolutely
climb the ladder in America.
Have to have some basis in education. When this ultimately, when the curtain sort of fell legally, it was actually prior to Brown v. Board. It was in 1946. There was a case called Mendez v. Westminster in California, which was specifically a legal challenge that made it to the Supreme Court. And the basis on which the Supreme Court decided that was the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Again, that legal argument had been made two decades before by the Mexican consul here in Kansas City. But what the Supreme Court said more specifically about that was that education is so fundamental to the capability of a person to engage in society and to be a productive citizen that it is just really – it flies in the face of the Constitution to think that a child who had nothing to do with creating the circumstances in which they found themselves in terms of legality, illegality, naturalization status, whatever the case might be, would basically be given a burden for their entire life of not having been educated as a child.
Yeah. The struggles of Mexican Americans to make their way in the Kansas City area back 100 years ago, 80 years ago, that's our topic. Let's go to a phone call here. Chris from Kansas City, Missouri. Chris, you're on with Daniel Serta. Good morning.
Good morning. I was wondering what kind of information you have on the people that went to St. Joseph, Missouri. That's where my family's from. There's a lot that went up there to work after the war. I would like to really put it that the war caused a lot of people to come up here. And I don't think very many people know what happened down there.
Sure.
During the revolution. And
Chris's family's from Mexico, it sounds like, Daniel. Yeah.
I have not looked specifically at St. Joseph, but you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the things you see is that when the revolution started, Mexicans fled, and they looked for other places to work, and there was certainly opportunity. They were actively being recruited by the meatpacking plants and by the railroads in Kansas City.
I was just curious, because they brought up four families.
And again, that's very typical of the pattern. Typically, there's one or two families that come up initially, and then effectively, you know, they become the bridge for other extended members of the family to come and relocate to that area.
How difficult was it for you, Daniel, to put together this history?
Well, it was incredibly challenging. You know, this was done under the auspices of a historic preservation grant. We were trying to actually document the physical sites. And it was astounding how difficult it was to do. You know, I'm very familiar with land records and deeds and all kinds of records. We had to really scour the four corners to even locate the physical properties where these schools were located. The worst of that was, again, the Melville School. There's no physical trace of it now. The school was sold to a local church, the building was, and the grounds back in the 1940s. The building was probably demolished sometime in the 1960s. There are a couple of very, standard sort of suburban ranch houses that have been built on the site. But it was ironic because we actually found an article from back in 1947 when the school district went to sell the school to the local church. And the article was noting that the school district itself could not find the abstract of title for the property. Mm-hmm. They couldn't find it in their own records, which to me is emblematic of the reality. It was almost under the radar. I mean, it was almost a shameful secret for the school district itself, so much so that records may have been lost of the existence of that school. There's no physical traces of the school, but what has really pulled the story into the present is the oral history, oral interviews that were done by Irene Reese when she was the librarian of what is now the West Branch of the Kansas City Public Library back in the 1970s, and then by my colleague Gene Chavez, interviews that he did in the late 1980s and early 1990s with a lot of these families. Again, these were people that as children attended these segregated schools. They would have been in their 50s and 60s at that time, and many of them have since passed.
Daniel Cerda will talk about all of this at 6 p.m. next Wednesday at the Kansas City, Kansas Public Library. This is October 9th. 3104 Strong Avenue. Daniel, thanks for the good information. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Yesterday in the show, we explored the issues faced by Native women and why we need to be paying attention to them. You can find that and other previous conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow on the show, an investigative journalist exposed corporate influence on agriculture and the food we eat through a weed killer once deemed safe enough to drink. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.